Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. Greetings from Osceola County in Central Florida. Many are traveling through here, no doubt, on their way to Tampa for the Super Bowl. So I hope they'll drop a lot of money while they're in this area. Greetings to our brethren in Kenya, in Maroba, or wherever else you are in Kenya. Greetings to you. Greetings to any of you who may be listening, wherever you're listening from. As I was mentioning, here in America, where I'm speaking from, and in Central Florida, it's Super Bowl Sunday. When I was back in Southern California, I used to boast about my career on the gridiron. I used to say I was a triple threat man. Trip, stumble, or fumble. So people were curious what position I played. Well, I told them, when I showed up for practice, the coach looked at me and said, "This is the end." No, I wasn't much of a football star, actually, but I will say this. I have seen the Pittsburgh Steelers when I was a young man, or not even that, less than that, you could say. I was a young man in one sense. I was a teenager, adolescent. I went to Yankee Stadium in New York City, the old Yankee Stadium, and I saw Pat Summerall, if you know who he is. I guess he's still around, still alive, but a retired announcer. But I saw him play, and I saw him kick 3 field goals for the New York Giants against the Steelers. And that's all the points the Giants got that day. They lost 14-9. So I saw the Steelers beat the Giants way back when, a long time ago. What happens tomorrow is anybody's guess. We have a new government in charge here, and as I speak, there are elections taking place in Iraq, and soon there'll be elections taking place in Israel. You know, you give some people an inch, they think they're rulers. But we are concerned, of course, always with how we're being governed, because it does have an impact on us. The way the world is, it's a struggle. This world is a struggle. All of us have, are aware of the survival of the fittest principle. And there is a power struggle that goes on in the world. You have the wealthy who like to hold on to their wealth and get more, you know. Let's call them business for the sake of a way of categorizing them. Let's call them big business. Then you have organized labor, and they're another power base. You have organized religion. It has its agenda. And then you have the government, the civil officials, and they have their desires to influence the world and to amass their own wealth and so on. So you have these various powerful forces, and the idea is to have enough of a balance that the average person is able to operate freely, do as best he or she can, reach his or her full potential without being overly exploited and trodden upon by these very powerful organized forces that exist that inevitably are going to form. You know, so it's a constant balance in the world. Now, we who are part of God's church, we're preparing, as we live this physical life, we're preparing to be a part of a government that will govern perfectly, that will govern effectively, that will produce the kind of environment that will really fulfill everybody's hopes and dreams. We have this lifetime to live a life that will prepare us for that. God has chosen us, if we're part of His church, to be a part of that governing authority in the future under Jesus Christ. But all through history, you know, people have sought the best human government possible. Of course, no human government is perfect. Some governments are better than others. Some can be helpful. Some can be very hurtful. And in a way, government is like fire. Fire is very helpful when it's under control. But out of control, fire is very destructive. But all through history, people have sought the right ruler. The right ruler. And that's what I'm calling this talk today. I want to just give a little bit of a piece of the history of the search for the right ruler. Ultimately, we know in the church the right ruler really is Jesus Christ. When He returns, we are going to have the kind of government that really everybody has been hoping for and dreaming of and wishing for. unfortunately, you know, people don't know how to, you know, how to get there, you know. But they will someday understand how they should be governed and who should be governing them. And we will have that time the right ruler. But in talking about this subject, I wanted to talk about a little known, not little known, I guess, but maybe underestimated, underemphasized hero of the Bible. And I'm just going to say a little bit about him today. But he had a very important role to play in God's plan in terms of selection of the right ruler. And that was the prophet and judge Samuel, Shmuel. He is, as I said, somewhat underrated when we think about biblical heroes. I don't think there's ever been a great movie about Samuel. There was a very nice animated, half an hour animated feature I thought was very well done by the Nest Company, if you get a chance to ever see it. And it, to me, it's very moving. As I said, it's only about an animated feature, about 30 minutes, but it does really give a nice summary of Samuel and his wonderful mother, Hannah. And so if you get a chance to see that or to show it to your children or grandchildren, that would be a wonderful thing. And speaking of grandchildren, in case we end this service early, it's because we're on our way to the hospital at celebration, you know, because my grandson is due on President's Day, but speaking about government, but he may come sooner than that. I'd like to go to the book of Hebrews, to the 11th chapter. Here you see that Samuel is in the Faith Hall of Fame. He is a very heroic figure. Well, of course, his name is well known. Sam is such a common name. We even call the United States Uncle Sam. So Sam, you know, the name Sam has caught on. Even women, Samantha, they call them Sam now. But anyway, in Hebrews 11, Shmuel was, of course, a blessed child. He came under special circumstances. And his name could mean, you know, the eternal heard or asked of the eternal. But, you know, because Hannah prayed especially for him and then dedicated him to God when he was born. And Hannah's prayer after he was born became a model for what Mary said when she was pregnant with Jesus. But anyway, in Hebrews 11, we hear, or the writer here is saying, "And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Biden." This is Barak, the judge who worked with Deborah. "And Samson and Jephthah." And our family, of course, is well aware of Jephthah's mighty deeds, you know, but that's another story. "And Jephthah, also of David, and Samuel, and the prophets." So it was. The pattern seems to be to talk of people who preceded others. You name one, and then you name one who preceded. And so David, who was preceded by Samuel. Now, the interesting thing is that God chose Samuel to anoint David to show that he would be set apart to be the king of Israel, and then his dynasty became the permanent dynasty that was chosen to rule over Israel and ultimately over the whole world. You know that Jesus Christ is humanly a descendant of David. So the ruler of the world is a descendant of David, and David was anointed by Samuel. I'd like to go to Acts, the 3rd chapter. Probably Samuel had something to do with the Bible as we know it, the canon, the scripture as we have it today. He was one of the few leaders who united the people of Israel in ancient times, who had universal respect and therefore would have had authority to have taken material and put it and included it into scripture to make it what we call canon, official scripture. And the beginning of the prophetic section is the work of Samuel. You know, the Bible, the Old Testament is in three parts: the law, the prophets, and the writings. And the prophets begin with what book? Hopefully you know, the book of Joshua. The prophets begin with the book of Joshua. I'm not talking about the King James Bible you have in front of you. I'm talking about the Hebrew order of the books: law, prophets, and writings. And we go to Acts 3, I hope, or I will, and hope that you'll join me. Acts 3, it says, here is Peter preaching a sermon, and he says, "Yes, and all the prophets from Samuel and those who follow, as many as have spoken, have also foretold these days." So Jesus Christ was foretold by all the prophets, beginning with Samuel. And Samuel was probably the author of the book of Joshua, which is the first book of the prophets. Now, Samuel had a tremendous amount of authority, as I said. And in fact, he may have been one of the few people ever, in fact, the only major figure in the Bible other than Jesus Christ himself, who had the experience of at least briefly being resurrected from the dead, if indeed he was. That's a question. 1 Samuel 28, sometime I'd like to discuss in terms of what really is happening there. But if so, then he was resurrected particularly to prophesy about David and David's importance, because David was very important, not only because he was a psalmist, not only because he was a heroic figure in biblical times and a model in many ways, even a model of what to do when you make a terrible mistake, but David also was the ancestor of Jesus Christ, humanly, and Samuel had the opportunity to choose him. But I want to talk about Samuel from the point of view of Psalm 99. Now, the opening prayer today came from Psalm 99, and that was the reason, because I had intended to talk about Samuel today and the search for the right ruler, the search for the right ruler. Psalm 99 and verse 6. Moses and Aaron were among his priests. Now, see, the priesthood came from the family of Levi, the tribe of Levi, and particularly the family of Aaron were the priests, the Aaronic branch, and then the other Levites were assistants. So Moses was a Levite, and his brother Aaron was the father of the priests, and then the other Levites assisted the priests. And Samuel was of that family. He was a Levite. He also was set apart especially to serve God, and he became a kind of a priest, although he wasn't technically an Aaronic priest, but he became a prophet and a judge. Moses and Aaron were among his priests, and Samuel was among those who called upon his name. They called upon the Eternal, and he answered them. So you see, this psalm, presumably of David, because there's no author listed here, could very well be of David. You know, David looks back to Samuel who anointed him, and here he mentions Moses, Aaron, and Samuel together, because that was Samuel's importance as one who helped to canonize Scripture. And I'll say more about that in a moment. I'd like to go to 1 Samuel 8. Now, as I said, we've struggled in human history with government and what the government's role ought to be and how powerful or weak a government ought to be and what form government ought to take. And all of these are very critical issues. Back in ancient Israel, God had ruled over the people through judges. And he did not have a powerful central government with all the trappings, you know, with beautiful palaces and with a standing army and with a king with a beautiful crown and robes and people assisting, waiting on him hand and foot and that sort of thing. You know, there were no kings and queens of that sort. There was Deborah, you know, the judge, and there were great judges and heroes, but there was not this emphasis on a monarchy and a royal family and an aristocracy. That was not how the nation was being run. But at the time, that's how other nations were being run. And it's funny how people are. You know, they copy others, even though the example is not always the right one. I'll give you an example. When I was growing up, my mother never smoked. I was not around smoking. My friends, as soon as they were old enough, wanted to kind of sneak around and try to smoke, and it was a big deal. And back when I was a child, of course, cigarettes were widely advertised on TV, and there were jingles to get people interested in smoking. When I was 11 years old, the children would walk around singing, "Winston tastes good like a cigarette should." You know, they were manipulated that way. Now probably those same people are paying a lot of money to try to quit, you know, because they realize it's hurting them. And now, why did they take it up in the first place? You know what we say, monkey see, monkey do. They grew up around parents who were smoking. And so, in effect, they just decided, well, I guess being an adult means you got to do it. So they, when they were 11, 12, they began to do it secretly. And then ultimately, they did it, you know, openly as teenagers. And now, as I said, in their adult years, they probably paid a lot of money to quit. But it's amazing. People will just copy what's around, whether it's good for them or not. They tend to do whatever's out there, whatever the prevailing customs are. And Israel saw the nations around them had these monarchs, and they kind of missed it. You know, they wanted to have a royal family, I guess, to get all gaga over. Like nowadays we get gaga over movie stars or professional athletes. In America particularly, movie stars are, you know, or now of course even the president's family has become almost like that, a sort of royal family in a way, and the Kennedys in a way were that way when they were here. But then in Britain, we have the royals and all the excitement about the royals. And some people seem to want to have that kind of thing. But also, it was a practical matter in their minds. They wanted a powerful government that they felt would be powerful enough to protect them, to defend them. They wanted to have a strong military. Now it's true that there were times when they needed help, but when they did, God would raise up a heroic figure, such as some of the ones I mentioned earlier. And those heroic figures did deliver Israel, but it was not the intention that Israel have a permanent, vast, you know, military establishment that could become, in effect, oppressive over Israel. You know, when you have a powerful military, it can defend you, but it can also wind up oppressing you, as that has happened in many countries. But Israel wanted to have this strong central government with a king they could identify with, a heroic figure they could rally behind, with an army, a trained professional army that could make them feel more secure. This was important to them at that time. And in a way, one can understand it. It's a lack of faith, and, you know. But we can understand it. But it to some degree was a lack of faith, because after all, these were people God had specifically worked with, performed miracles for, and they weren't like other nations. They were supposed to be unique. They were supposed to be a nation who relied more on God than on powerful figures, on heroes and idols of their own creation. They were supposed to be a nation rather who had faith, you know, in God. But, you know, people being what they are, they wanted to have something more tangible. So it came to a head at the time of Samuel, because he was greatly respected. He was a great judge, but unfortunately his children didn't follow in his footsteps. And that's a lesson in itself. As great a man as Samuel was, somehow his children didn't follow his example. Now maybe it was partly a matter of their mother. Not that I want to, you know, criticize her, but that might have been a factor there. Or maybe the fact that he just wasn't around enough to be with his children because of all his responsibilities. But in any case, they didn't follow in his footsteps. This became then an excuse for what's about to come. So let's start. Let's begin in 1 Samuel 8. I'm now in 1 Samuel 8. Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. You know, as they say, 'twas ever thus, right? Corruption in government. Here we go again, right? So sad. And they had a very good example from their dad, because he had a spotless record, but they were corrupted. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." So this was their excuse. They didn't have to do it this way. They could have gone to God, and God could have intervened and raised up a judge for them to follow in Samuel's footsteps. But no, they wanted a king. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Eternal. And this is one verse that we ought to focus on. It's 1 Samuel 8, 7. "And the Eternal said to Samuel, 'Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them.'" They just didn't have the faith to trust God to rule over them in a more simple way, what we might call a more republican way, a more democratic way, where you didn't have all the trappings of a powerful central government. They didn't trust God to rule over them with a judge. They wanted to have a monarchy, royalty, such as the nations around them had, you know, the excitement, the pageantry, you know, the hoopla. You know, they wanted that because they weren't comfortable having that kind of faith in God. They didn't have it. And so God continues here. "According to all the works which they have done since the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." Just like, you know, you could do the same thing, which, as I said, with the children in my example earlier. They want to take up smoking to be like their parents. You know, you could tell the kids, your parents wish they didn't smoke now, probably. Your parents, you know, are figuring out, you know, trying to quit. "So Samuel told all the words of the Eternal to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, 'This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. This is typically how monarchs behaved. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow the ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. You know, you're going to have conscripted labor, conscripted military, that sort of thing. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants. This is what typically happens, you know, with governments. You take property from people to give it to ones who are your, you know, supporters, your cronies, and so on. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. So you're not going to just be paying tithes now. You'll be paying an additional tithe, which is going to be, you know, for the needs of this new form of government you've chosen. And he will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And so often, you know, we've had oppressive monarchs in history, and people, you know, who cried out under these oppressive monarchs. We have the famous Robin Hood legend in the English-speaking world about how Prince John was so oppressive and taxing the people. So Robin Hood was out there in Sherwood Forest, you know. We know those stories. Verse 18, and you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you've chosen for yourselves, and the Eternal will not hear you in that day. You know, you made your bed, now you're going to have to lie in it. If that's the kind of government you want this form of government, then you're going to have to deal with the consequences of it. And this did happen under Solomon. As great a king as he was, as wise a king as he was, the people in the north, particularly of the country, found him oppressive. All this wealth was going to the capital. They didn't feel that they were benefiting that much from it, and they felt it oppressed by it. And finally, when his son seemed to be even more oppressive, they pulled out. You know, the country split. Verse 19. Nevertheless, you know, so even after all these warnings, you know, as we know, this is how people tend to be. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king over us. They wanted, you know, they wanted what other nations had. It seemed more secure to them, more stable, more effective. That's what seemed to be, you know, the in thing. That we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. That was a very important part of it. You know, to have security against their enemies. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Eternal. So the Eternal said to Samuel, heed their voice and make them a king. And Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. So, okay, settle down and we'll deal with it. You know, you will have a king. The next chapter is interesting. It talks about Saul. Now, Saul is a Lincoln-esque figure in the beginning. A tall, lanky, you know, man, you know, young man, although more handsome probably than Abe Lincoln was thought of. You know, he evidently was a more charismatic figure to look at. But Saul was also very modest, as I believe Lincoln was. Saul was tall and impressive, but at the same time, he was a rather meek person, he was going after lost donkeys and wound up being given a kingdom. The famous story in 1 Samuel 9, searching for lost donkeys, and you wind up, you know, being told you're going to be king of Israel. But he didn't make a big deal about it then. He didn't publicize it. So let's skip 1 Samuel 9 and go to 1 Samuel 10. This is where Samuel gathers the people together and publicly announces that Saul is to be their king, Shaul of the tribe of Benjamin. So now we go to 1 Samuel 10, and the people are gathered together, and now Samuel's going to reveal, all right, you wanted a king, and I've chosen quite a hunk for you, quite a man. He's tall, he's impressive. God has chosen him, and has revealed that to me. So now we're in 1 Samuel 10, verse 20. Actually, I want to go back just a bit, because Samuel is still warning them. You know, even as he chooses the king, he still warns them, you don't know what you're in for, wanting a monarchy. 1 Samuel 10:17. Then Samuel called the people together to the Eternal at Mizpah, and said to the children of Israel, "Thus says the eternal God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians, from the hand of the kingdoms, and from those who oppressed you. But you have today rejected your God, who himself saved you from all your adversaries, all your adversities and your tribulations, and you've said to him, 'No, set a king over us.' Now therefore present yourselves before the Eternal by your tribes and by your clans." And when Samuel had caused all the tribes of Israel to come near, the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. So here God is making his will known, evidently through some kind of lottery system. He's making his will known, which he'd already done to Samuel and to Saul in a private way, but now it's becoming public. When he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri was chosen, and Saul the son of Kish was chosen. And when they sought him, he could not be found. So he wasn't out there sort of campaigning. He knew he was going to be king, but he wasn't out there, kissing babies, what do you call that, pressing the flesh, campaigning. No. Therefore, they inquired of the Eternal further. They're actually looking to God, where is this man? We know who you want, but where is he? Has the man come here yet? And the Eternal answered, there he is, hidden among the equipment. So he's out there kind of, maybe he felt, had second thoughts about wanting to be king. It kind of reminds me again of Abe Lincoln. As far as I understand, when he finally had to become president, what a mess he knew he was getting into. The seven states had left the Union, and of course, four more were going to. It was a mess that he had to deal with. His predecessor, Buchanan, had done virtually nothing to, deal with the issues that had come up. In those days, you were elected in November. You didn't take office till March. By the time March rolled around, the crisis was so deep. So Lincoln, there wasn't any euphoria when Lincoln took office. And maybe the same thing with Saul. As you'll see later on, there was a crisis brewing that he had to deal with. Anyway, so they ran and brought him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And people tend to like that in a leader. And I know Americans like that. It's amazing to me. Usually the taller man wins in an election, quite often. George Washington was very tall for his time. And Lincoln was very tall for his time. And, I often notice when Israelis come over here, the Israeli prime minister and the American president, almost always the American president is taller than the Israeli prime minister. But anyway, Saul was very tall, so he was very impressive. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Eternal has chosen? That there is no one like him." I'm in 1 Samuel 10:24. "There is no one like him among all the people." So all the people shouted and said, "Yehi HaMelech." Long live the king. Yehi ke viva el rey, if they had been Hispanics, right? Long live the king. Then Samuel explained to the people the behavior of royalty, and wrote it in a book, and laid it up before the Eternal. So it was very important. If you're going to have a king, these are the parameters. These are the rules he must follow. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his house. And Saul also went home to Gibeah, and valiant men went with him whose hearts God had touched. So he did begin to develop a following of good people, devoted people, who wanted him to be successful. But there were the dissenters. And even though God had chosen him, he hadn't really done anything yet to convince them. And the way it's amazing how Israelites, they are stiff-necked people. And even though God did so much for them, there were always the skeptics. And here in verse 27, "But some rebels said, 'How can this man save us?' So they despised him and brought him no presents." They didn't give him any particular honor. The great new king. No, they began to bash him, as it were. But he held his peace. As I said, he was a humble person. He didn't try to go after them, deal with them. He held his peace. Now, here's what I want to say. Here's what I believe happened. I believe that Samuel added to the canon of the Bible at this time. He went back. He went to the book of Deuteronomy, Moses' last words, and he added a section about the monarchy. I want to go to Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 17. I do believe that this section was added under divine inspiration by Samuel when the Israelites decided they wanted a king, and he integrated it into this material, which has to do with government. This part of Deuteronomy is expounding on the principle of honor your father and your mother, and it goes into the principle of government and governmental officials. and how they are to conduct themselves and how we are to respect their authority. We follow that? So let's go to Deuteronomy 17, and I believe this section was added by Daniel. I'm sorry, by Samuel. I'm in Deuteronomy 17 and verse 14. When you come into the land, this is Deuteronomy 17, 14. When you come to the land which the Eternal your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Eternal your God chooses. So if you want a king, then all right, I'll concede, I'll give you a king, but then I want to choose your king. You need to take the king that I choose. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. So do not accept a king over you who is not of your own people. And America has adopted this principle. In the American Constitution, as we know, our president must be American born. And I think that principle is a biblical principle. Because if you're born in a nation, you have a certain sense of the heart and soul of the nation. It's not that you can't love the nation as an immigrant who comes here, and maybe even more so, but you don't have that same always sense of just what the core culture of the nation is if you haven't grown up in the culture. You know, there isn't quite the same, you may love it even more, but you still don't have that same familiarity and comfort with the basic culture when you have come from another place. Anyway, verse 16, but he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. So don't get carried away with yourself and go in for all these perks, you know. For the Eternal has said to you, you shall not return that way again. So don't make compromises to add to your own wealth and power and prestige. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. So don't be a womanizer. Nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. You know, it's quite interesting now, being president of the United States now, since that's a parallel we can relate to. Frankly, you really become very, very wealthy. You probably need to be wealthy to even be president now, which wasn't always the case. Or at least you have to have wealthy backers. But once you leave, the opportunities for wealth afterwards are just tremendous. If you look at the history of the presidency, earlier presidents did not have the same opportunity to acquire such wealth as beginning perhaps in the 70s presidents were able to do. You know, in recent years, our presidents, once they leave, if you can get there and spend 8 years or even four, you know, you can really, you can be set for life as far as wealth, if that's what you want, you know. But the king was told not to have his mind on that and not to use his monarchy to acquire a lot for himself. Well, now as you hear this, you're thinking, what about Solomon? You know, he was supposed to be so wise, and yet he did these sorts of things. And well, that was his undoing. You know, that's why the nation split after his reign. He evidently thought he was an exception to the rule. I'm so wise. God has given me such wisdom. I can handle these things. I can have all these women and all this wealth, and I can handle it. No. You know, there was a Lord Acton who famously said, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know, we have to be careful. People are people, and people are subject to be compromised when they get this kind of an environment. More and more power, more prestige, more and more wealth, more and more self-gratification, self-indulgence. It finally leads to a self-destructive mentality. Verse 18. Also it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. Now that, by the way, is one asset our present president has. He's a constitutional lawyer, so he knows the laws of the country. You know, a president, you know, Josephus pointed out that among the Jews, every week they go to synagogue and hear the Torah. That means the average Jewish person knows the laws that he has to live by. He said the average ruler doesn't know the laws of his own country and has to hire lawyers to tell him what the laws are. You know, And the king of Israel, on the other hand, was supposed to know the law. He was supposed to copy, make a copy for himself. That's one way to force yourself to learn it, when you have to write it all out for yourself. And he had to take the official copy and copy it and write it out a copy of the law for himself so that he would be very well aware of it. And it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Eternal his God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes. So the president, the king of a nation is not above the law. Now David learned this. You know, David began to think of himself as an exception. Finally, he came to his senses, and his life was spared, and he continued to rule, although he had a lot of bitterness afterwards for what he did. But a president is not above the law, or a king. I shouldn't say president. This is dealing with a king. But a ruler, a governor, a governing authority, a mayor, a governor, you know, a emperor, a president, a queen, empress, you know, what you name the term, is not above the law. Verse 20. Why should he do these things? Why should he copy the law? Why should he study the law? Why should he be careful? Verse 20, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. For stability of the nation, for stability of his reign, for the good of the country, he needs to be a virtuous ruler. It also, of course, sets an example for the rest of the country. You know, if a government is known to be corrupt, if a ruler is known to be corrupt, that eventually gets out. The word gets out. And then everybody else is affected by it. The whole land is ultimately affected by a corrupt ruler. And the opposite. A very virtuous ruler can influence a whole nation to be more virtuous. Okay, let's continue on then here in chapter 11. So this is the background to what Samuel tried to do. He tried to warn them. He tried to then regulate the monarchy. God did intervene he allowed a monarchy, but then regulated it. And here we go now in chapter 11. Now remember, Saul was still having to establish his reputation. People said, "Long live the king," but yet there were those who doubted. So now he established his reputation, and God used him to deliver Israel from a foreign oppressor. So here we have the account in chapter 11. Now, when you read this account, as I read it to you, you'll notice how the Middle East, just as always the way it is, the Middle East remains the Middle East. It's like the famous story of the fox and the scorpion. They're by the river. It's let's call it the Jordan River. They're by the Jordan River, and the fox wants to get across the river, and the fox can swim. The scorpion can't swim. So the scorpion says to the fox, "While you're swimming across the Jordan, can I jump on your back and then you can give me a ride across?" And the fox said, "Come on, are you crazy? I'm supposed to swim across the Jordan River while you're on my back? You'll sting me." The scorpion says, "Now you're the one being crazy. If I sting you, I'm going to drown too." So the fox said, "Yeah, you're right. Okay, so hop on." So they're halfway across the Jordan, and the scorpion does sting the fox. So as the fox is beginning to sink and drown, he says to the scorpion, "This doesn't make any sense, this self-destructive behavior. How could you do such a thing like this?" And the scorpion said, "This is the Middle East." You know, that's just the way it is there. You know. Anyway, then Nahash the Ammonite. Now here we're on the east bank of the Jordan River, and we have this ruler whose name evidently means serpent. So Nahash. Anyway, so Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Make a covenant with us, and we will serve you." They were stuck, you know, so they were willing to back down. This is evidently some of the eastern branch of the tribe of Manasseh. They were willing to back down. But look at what his conditions are. And Nahash the Ammonite answered them, "On this condition I'll make a covenant with you, that I may put out all your right eyes and bring reproach on all Israel." So the adult males of that city are going to have all their right eyes put out. Evidently, this makes them very ineffective as warriors, I believe is why you would do this. Because like if you have your shield, most people are right-handed. If you have your shield in your left hand, you know, you can't even see what you're doing. Or if you're trying to pull a bow, you know, you can't really focus. So the idea is that it makes them ineffective as warriors. But that wasn't the only reason he was doing it. He was doing it just to insult them, to humiliate them, as he says. He did it to bring reproach on all Israel. That was the point. To dig in, you know, dig in your dagger, as it were. And in this case, he literally was going to dig his dagger in into their right eyes. You know, so verse 3. Then the elders of Jabesh said to him, "Hold off for 7 days, that we may send messengers to all the territory of Israel. And then if there is no one to save us, we will come out to you." So they were very frank about it. They said, "We don't want to do this. If we can fight you, we will. But give us a week." And he evidently felt like, nah, they're going to be too afraid. They won't come. He actually gave them the time to do it. So I guess this was his arrogance, which was his undoing. So the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and told the news in the hearing of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. But Saul did more than weep. Saul, at this time in his life, had a certain confidence in God. Samuel had anointed him king. And he trusted in God that he could deliver him. So let's not just sit around and cry. Let's do something about this. Now there was Saul coming behind the herd from the field. And Saul said, "What troubles the people that they weep?" And they told him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard this news. And his anger was greatly aroused. So if you have God's Spirit, you know, you will have at times righteous indignation. Anger over hideous things, unfair things that happen. So he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel, excuse me, by the hands of messengers, saying, "Whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen." In other words, we're going to deal with people who aren't going to be supportive. So he was being very assertive now of his monarchy, and of course he brought Samuel in as God's prophet. And he said, "We're going to deal with you if you don't come forward and help." And the fear of the Eternal fell on the people, and they came out with one consent. So people were aroused and came out. When he numbered them in Bezek, the children of Israel were 300,000 and the men of Judah 30,000. So he had a major force to go against this other nation. So, as I said, this other nation had really overplayed their hand. They had been arrogant and they had overplayed their hand. And now they were going to get, you know, going to get dealt with. And they said to the messengers who came, "Thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have help." Then the messengers came and reported it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, "Tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do with us whatever seems good to you." Now maybe that was the message they sent back to the ruler, you know, that they would, that, you know, they will come out to him because they figured by that time the Israelites would be there. So it's a question whether they're telling this to the Israelites or telling this to Nahash. But it was the next day when Saul came. Verse 11. So it was on the next day that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch and killed Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it happened that those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. A very decisive victory. Very decisive victory. Completely crushed the opposition. Virtually wiped them out. So now Saul had become a national hero. So now any of the dissenters would have been silenced. Because now they should be convinced that Saul's the one. Then the people said to Samuel, "Who is he who said, 'Shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death.'" So now they wanted to deal with any of the dissenters. Remember, Saul had not gone after them. Nor does he now go after them. Wonderful attitude on his part. You know, you have to be willing to deal with some people that are not going to just, you know, sort of, you know, lick your feet or whatever. Not everybody's going to necessarily be that way right off. You got to give people some slack. But Saul said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day. For today the Eternal has accomplished salvation in Israel." Don't spoil the day by wanting to wreak vengeance on your own people who were skeptical. Then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there." So now that Saul had shown himself a hero, Samuel gathered the people together to renew their commitment to Saul as the leader. And of course he took the opportunity once again to correct the people, to preach to them, as you'll see in a moment. Anyway, verse 15. So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Eternal in Gilgal. There they made sacrifices of peace offerings before the Eternal. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Now, this is a wonderful beginning, and it's so sad when you read the rest of the story. Saul, unfortunately, was corrupted by leadership. He lost his humility. He became, a wretch at the end of his life. He became a mental case. It's very, very sad what happened to him. And it is sad what often happens to people when they get up that high, that powerful, how their values begin to get perverted and go askew, and they become self-destructive. It's very, very sad. And it was a very sad, very sad about Saul. As a result, David was given authority, and God made a commitment to David eventually that his dynasty would become the dynasty of the Messiah. And so David, a man after God's own heart, even though he had his flaws through his life, but he had that desire to please God that never left him. That kind of a man became the ancestor of Jesus Christ. And it is Jesus Christ then who will be able to come and provide the kind of government that we want. All other governments are going to fall short. As you go through history and you evaluate them, they're all going to fall way short of the government that Jesus Christ is going to bring. That's why every day we pray, "Your kingdom come," because we want that kind of government. We want to be a part of that. That's why we're living the lives we're living, so that we can be a part of that. Anyway, in 1 Samuel 12, "Now Samuel said to all Israel, 'Indeed, I have heeded your voice and all that you have said to me, and have made a king over you. And now here is the king walking before you, and I am old and gray-headed, and look, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my childhood to this day.'" His sons, of course, were grown. They were judges now themselves. Unfortunately, they weren't doing that well. But it was just a sign of his age that he had now adult children. "Here I am, witness against me before the Eternal and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken, or whose donkey have I taken, or whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed, or from whose hand have I received any bribe with which to blind my eyes? I will restore it to you." Unfortunately, we are living in times now where there are many people in positions of responsibility who can't make this kind of a comment, honestly. "And they said, 'You have not cheated or oppressed us, nor have you taken anything from any man's hand.' Then he said to them, 'The Eternal is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand.' And they answered, 'He is witness.'" So Samuel had been a ruler who was not a corrupt ruler, not a taker of bribes, didn't exploit his position for personal gain. "Then Samuel said to the people, 'It is the Eternal who raised up Moses and Aaron, and who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still, that I may reason with you before the Eternal concerning all the righteous acts of the Eternal which he did to you and your fathers.' When Jacob had gone into Egypt," I'm now in verse 8 of 1 Samuel 12, "and your fathers cried out to the Eternal, then the Eternal sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. Then they forgot the Eternal their God." And so then, under the judges, we have various heroes that were raised up at times. "He sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. Then they cried out to the Eternal and said, 'We have sinned, because we have forsaken the Eternal and served the Baals and the Ashtoreths. But now deliver us from the hand of our enemies, and we will serve you.'" And whenever they did that, God did respond. It was a cycle, Sin, repentance, response, if you read the book of Judges. "And the Eternal sent Jerubbaal," which is another name for Gideon, "Bedan," and Bedan is, here we go with Biden again. No, this is Bedan, and this is a nickname, or another form of the name, of probably Abdon, who was a judge. And let's go to Judges 12, because he's, again, a person probably more obscure to some of you. This is possibly Abdon, who came after Jephthah. If you'll indulge me, let's go to Judges 12:13. We have Jephthah ruling, and then we have after him a ruler named Ibzan, and then Elon, and then finally Abdon in verse 13. "After him, Abdon," this is Judges 12:13, "the son of Hillel, the Perathonite, judged Israel, and he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 young donkeys. He judged Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Perathonite, died and was buried in Pirathon in the land of Ephraim in the mountains of the Amalekites." So his career is mentioned here, and evidently he had a basically a peaceful and prosperous career. So he's mentioned perhaps in this passage by Samuel. Gideon is mentioned, and then this Bedan, who is perhaps another form of Abdon's name. Then Jephthah is mentioned in Samuel. Samuel mentions himself. And delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you dwelt in safety. I'm in now back in Judges 12:11. And when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, "No, but a king shall reign over us." So now you see a little more of the background of why they wanted Saul. Again, it had to do with this threat of foreign oppression. They felt more comfortable with a monarchy. They felt this was a better face, you know, to show to these other nations. It was, you know, a lack of faith on their part, but it's understandable. So I'm quoting again. "No, but a king shall reign over us when the Eternal your God was your king." You know, but you couldn't have this unseen king. You had to have all the, you know, the trappings of a monarch, the palace and the, you know, the gold and the chariots and, you know, all of that. You wanted that. "Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. And take note, the Eternal has set a king over you." In other words, he did what you wanted. He gave you the form of government you wanted. "If you fear the Eternal and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Eternal, then both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Eternal your God. However, if you do not obey the voice of the Eternal and rebel against the commandment of the Eternal, then the hand of the Eternal will be against you as it was against your fathers." I mean, you ought to learn from the past that sin brings penalty. "Now therefore, stand and see this great thing which the Eternal will do before your eyes." So he actually had a miracle performed for them so that they would get the point. This is not just some old man blabbing away here. This is a prophet of God giving you instruction, and you need to listen. "Is today not the wheat harvest?" So this is evidently late spring, around Pentecost, sometime after Pentecost. "Is today not the wheat harvest? I will call to the Eternal, and he will send thunder and rain, that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Eternal, and asking a king for yourselves." There normally wouldn't have been a heavy rainfall that time of year. There would have been lighter rain somewhat that time of year, but heavy rain would have been rare. And specifically to say it's coming right now, you know, people don't just do that. If I went outside right now and said, "Thunder, rain," you know, I wouldn't be so presumptuous as to do that. "Is today not the wheat harvest? I will call to the Eternal, and he will send thunder and rain, that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Eternal, and asking a king for yourselves." So Samuel called to the Eternal, and the Eternal sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Eternal and Samuel. So this was like an exclamation point on his talk, you know. This got their attention. And then the people began to feel guilty. You know, as usual, you have this remorse when it's too late. You know, now that they've got the monarch, he's been chosen, we've gone through all the trouble of it, now they say, "Well, I guess we blew it, we shouldn't have done it." You know, it's like what happened when the spies came and they said, we can't go there. And then finally God said, "Yes, you will go there." And then they said, "Oh, now we need to go there." And they try to invade on their own. You know, I'm summarizing back in the book of Numbers because I've talked about it in recent months. So here we go again. It's remorse too late. "And all the people said to Samuel, 'Pray for your servants to the Eternal your God that we may not die, for we have added to all our sins the evil of asking a king for ourselves.'" Now they realize that they shouldn't have done that. They should have been content with God's form of government that he gave them originally. But it's too late now. I mean, you're going to have a monarch, so I'm going to give you the experience of dealing with it. Since you wanted one, you know, I want you to have the experience of dealing with it so you'll know it's not the solution. There are no political solutions, ultimately. The solutions are spiritual, ultimately. It doesn't mean, you know, that people... I'm not condemning people who try to do as best they can, but we have to realize the ultimate solutions are spiritual ones. It's going to take God's government to finally bring the world what it needs, what it wants, what it should have. "Then Samuel said to the people, 'Do not fear. You have done all this wickedness. Yet do not turn aside from following the Eternal, but serve the Eternal with all your heart. And do not turn aside, for then you would go after empty things, which cannot profit or deliver, for they are nothing.'" Just do the right thing now, and this will work out. You know, you made it. You know, this wouldn't have been plan A, but it can work if you're obedient. "For the Eternal will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Eternal to make you his people." Now, for lack of time, I won't turn there, but every Wednesday in the temple and now in the synagogues, the Psalm 94 is recited, And probably it is based on this verse. You know, what you see in Psalm 94 to some degree is based on 1 Samuel 12:22. So you might, in connection with this, go over to Psalm 94. A good margin would have it. I want to criticize. I don't normally criticize Bible versions, but in my margin here, Psalm 94 isn't in here, but it should be. Anyway, for the Eternal will not forsake His people, for His great name's sake, because it has pleased the Eternal to make you His people. You know, God is going to fulfill, as you know in Philippians 1:6, if He wants you in His kingdom, you'll be there. You know, so don't despair. Don't get discouraged. You know, just hang in there. He will see to it you make it. If He has chosen you, you'll make it. He chose Israel, and Israel's going to make it, ultimately. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Eternal in ceasing to pray for you. But I will teach you the good and the right way. So here Samuel says, as a prophet of God, I would be sinning if I didn't pray for you and if I didn't try to teach you the right thing. You know, so any of us in the ministry have that responsibility, you know, to pray for the people with whom we're dealing and to try to teach them the right thing. That's what that's my responsibility. Verse 24. Only fear the Eternal and serve Him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things He has done for you. We can certainly say that, and knowing God's plan, we know what great things He will yet do. But we know more than they, because we know about Christ's sacrifice and all of that history, which they didn't know about. They might have known about it in terms of prophecy, if they really understood prophecy, but we know about it historically, what Christ did for us. Verse 25, but if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king. And this is, of course, unfortunately, what happened to the nation. You know, so in summary, we see that the nation of Israel wanted to have a government more like other governments. They were warned such a government would not be a picnic. Ultimately, they'd be sorry they asked for it. You know, but nevertheless, it can work as a temporary solution if you are good people, if you're virtuous people. The government can function and things can work out, you know, and ultimately, of course, God will rule over you. But in the meantime, you want this form, I'll deal with this form. You want another form, I'll deal with that form. The main thing is realize that none of these forms are ideal. The ideal is to be virtuous and then to look to God's government. So in conclusion, I want to go to Acts 13. Acts 13. And here is another reference to Samuel in the New Testament. And when you piece the Greek together of the original text, The idea is this, that we had a 450-year period from the time they entered the land until the death of David. And during that time, they had judges, and finally culminating in Samuel. So I'm going to read it in Acts 13:20. It's translated somewhat awkwardly in the version I'm reading, but I want to get to the part that I want to end with here. Acts 13:20. After that, he gave them judges for about 450 years, until Samuel the prophet, verse 21, Acts 13:21, and afterward they asked for a king. So God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. And now in verse 22, and when he had removed him, he raised up for them David as king. So Samuel was the one chosen to anoint David, who would be the ancestor of Jesus Christ. So he began the process by which God finally will bring peace and prosperity to this world, through Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the son of David, Mashiach ben David, Christos, the Christ. And when he had removed him, he raised up for them David as king, to whom he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will. Such is the kind of person God wants to be a ruler over others, one who will seek God's will, and who will have an interaction with Him, a relationship with Him. And we are doing that from day to day. We who are members of God's church, we're developing a relationship with God because we want to be a part of God's universe ruling family. Verse 23, talking about David. From this man's seed, according to the promise, God raised up for Israel a Savior, Jesus. Jesus is indeed the right ruler. He's the righteous ruler who will come and bring us all that is good and all that we're hoping for and praying for, and we can be a part of His future world ruling kingdom. So I thank you for listening, and those some of you will be listening at a later time. Thank you for those listening live. It's nice to have a live audience, And of course, those who come, we appreciate the ones in the room, of course, and then those out there in computer land, and then those who will be listening in other times, in Africa or wherever you are. So we pray that your Sabbath will go very well, and that your week ahead will go very well. All the best to you and yours.